In 1880, the U.S. government had a problem. There were so many people in the nation that the 1880 census took 8 years to finish. Luckily, a teenager who was frustrated with his job came up with an idea for the next one. We'll discuss his idea, but first, a little bit about a popular American holiday. In 1861, Mexican President Benito Juarez, the first Mexican leader of Indian descent, a Zapotec from the Oaxaca region of Mexico, a lawyer and a popular politician, found his country's finances in sorry shape. This, the result of a civil war between his Mexican liberals and the Mexican conservatives. What did he do? He canceled interest payments on foreign debts. The three nations that were creditors to Mexico didn't like this very much. France, Spain, and Great Britain then sent ships over and stormed the city of Veracruz and took over the customs house there. But Emperor Louis Napoleon, Napoleon III of France, wanted more. And French forces actually invaded the interior of the country. Upon seeing this, the British and Spanish forces took off. They were just there to collect debts, not to build an empire. In May of 1862, as Lincoln okayed General George McClellan's ambitious peninsular campaign to subdue Confederates at Richmond, after he took the town of Yorktown, French forces took advantage of our being a little bit busy and attacked the city of Puebla, a heavily fortified town not far from Mexico City, where the bulk of the Mexican army was positioned. They were outnumbered, 6,500 to 4,500. French artillery shelled the town, but the fortifications were effective. Two assaults were called, each one beat back by the defending Mexican army. On the third assault, the French cannons were out of ammunition and could not support the infantry. The Mexican army, while defending, they also brought troops along the road that the French would need to retreat along and concealed them. Then the Mexican cavalry smashed the French forces. They retreated from their assault from the right, and the concealed forces sniped at them from the left. As if this wasn't enough of a sorry mess for the French, it started to rain, and the road was muddy. The result was a massacre and a defeat for the French as they lost 462 men. This was the Battle of Puebla. It was celebrated throughout the nation of Mexico that they had repulsed the French invasion. It's still celebrated in Puebla today. The French people, though, were outraged by this defeat. Napoleon III sent more troops, 30,000 of them. And just a little before the Battle of Gettysburg, they were coming back and conquering Puebla and the rest of Mexico. And for a short while, French controlled Mexico, and an Austrian archduke became emperor of the nation. Until when the U.S. wrapped up the Civil War, put diplomatic pressure on the French to leave, and eventually sent a general to the Texas border to enforce it. French left, the Austrian archduke was shot, and Benito Juarez again became president. That battle, though, the Battle of Puebla, the early triumph of Republican forces in Mexico, occurred on May 5th. Adolf Vega writes, "You should do a podcast on Cinco de Mayo. It's not just a Mexican holiday. It's an important event in American history." Well, Adolf, your wish is my command. We should know the history of that day as we toss the margaritas and dance the mariachi jarabe. It is not just some day we celebrate. It's not, as many think, the celebration of Mexican independence. The Mexicans were already independent at the time of the Cinco de Mayo battle. It's part of a larger history. It could have been a sad one for Mexico and for us if we had a competing European nation on our border. So Cinco de Mayo maybe is something legitimate for us Americans to celebrate. It's not just for Mexicans. And indeed, the holiday is probably celebrated more in the United States than in Mexico. It's celebrated in certain regions of Mexico, particularly in the state of Puebla, the city of Puebla, and on the U.S. border. I know it's not the biggest political problem facing us today. What is Cinco de Mayo? But I thought it was something interesting to discuss. And now you have a little factoid that you can tell people. You should know. What's Cinco de Mayo? Celebrates the Battle of Puebla. One problem for the U.S. government was the census in 1880. In 1880, it took until 1888 to finish the count of all Americans called for by the Constitution. Herman Hollerith worked on the U.S. Census as an enumerator when he was 19, and he was annoyed by the manual process, the tabulation that would occur. There must be an easier way, the son of German immigrants thought, than taking all these sheets of paper from the counters and tabulating them by hand in a central office. He noticed something. When he rode on the train, the conductors would take a ticket and punch parts of it. The parts of the ticket would signify the appearance of the passenger. Tall, short, white, black, blonde, brunette. Railroads called it a punch photograph, and it would ensure that only the person paying would be able to use that ticket. Aha, Hollerith thought. Take a card the size of one of the dollar bills back then, which in 1880 were a bit larger than today's. They could fit 12 rows and 24 columns. That's 288 potential points of data. Then he invented the Hollerith census counting machine, a large wooden cabinet, kind of like a big tall piano almost, with a press. The press had pins on it, but they were flexible pins, and they would give if the pins met paper and retreat inwards. If there was no paper present, it would connect and give an electric charge, and voila, register a count for that data point of the 288. It was not a perfect system. You still had to punch those cards and then put it into this tabulating machine that Hollerith invented. There was a manual mechanism for that. And of course, you had to count. But the counting was much faster this way than doing it with a bunch of human beings making totals. In 1890, the United States government bought Hollerith's machines for the census and hired Hollerith to wire or program them and completed the 1890 census of 62 million Americans in 6 weeks. And this census included more than just how many people were in America, but also how many poor, how many widowed, how many disabled, how many Union veterans, all kinds of good information. Unfortunately, all that information was lost in fires at two different occasions. Those punch cards on the Hollerith machines, same size, just about, were used up until the 1970s and even entered politics. Barry Goldwater attacked the plans of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society with a TV ad saying that every American would now be reduced to a punch card. Actually, that may have occurred 70 years before. On the My History Can Beat Up Your Politics Facebook site, D. Allen Ridgway asks, what about the government's new investment in big data? Pros and cons, any privacy concerns? Well, to hear proponents of big data tell it, we may be back in the same type of information problem as 1880. And what does that mean? Well, we've got a lot of data these days. Retail UPC scans, traffic light cameras, medical records, legal records, seismic monitors, security systems, locks, military drones with cameras, patient monitoring systems, websites, Facebook pages. This is all great. But what do you do with all this data? How can you analyze and benefit from it? Here's how the Defense Research Agency, DARPA, explains it. Picture trying to find a 50-gallon drum in the Atlantic Ocean. There's 100 billion gallons of water, estimated, in the Atlantic Ocean. You're just not going to find it. Well, if you consider that each of those gallons in the ocean is one byte of data, that's the amount of data the Atlantic Ocean that was generated in 2010 alone. Systems, software algorithms need to be developed so that we can access the data, store the data, analyze the data, say, what is it? And where can we find the piece we're looking for, the patterns we're looking for? Otherwise, having all these systems out there to collect data is not useful. And this is very important for us human beings, to be able to visualize the data, give it shape, form, apply colors to it, detect patterns, and make those patterns visible. So DARPA wants this big data software. What's the use of sending drones across the earth with robotic camera eyes if you can't do anything with the output? Geologic Survey wants it, as so does the Department of Energy, the National Institute of Health for the genomic molecular data that is very complicated. The Obama administration, all departments consider plans to invest $250 million in this big data. There are benefits and downsides from my view. The downside, of course, is privacy, information, and analysts at the hands of the government, and with citizens unable to possess it or really even understand all of it, at least for a time, right? The data is too big for the government to understand right now. How are citizens ever going to understand it? Freedom of Information Act gets tougher when we're talking about T-bytes of data, and you don't have the big data computer on your end to do anything with it. Yet you have to look at the benefits, too, with anything like this. Maybe we can detect events around the world, natural disasters, or human disasters such as uprising that might lead to great costs for us years from now, sending our boys over to a region of the world instead of a drone. Maybe the genomic data leads to better treatments down the road. Maybe the detection of patterns across cities helps us to reduce crime. Some will say that privacy is so valuable that we can't trade anything for it. But is that realistic? Here's a wild but somewhat historical example that I can apply to this question a little bit here. We often hear about J. Edgar Hoover. There's the Leonardo DiCaprio movie, many books about it. He was a scary individual, and I think it's safe to say one of these people that were dangerous to a full democracy. Truman was wary of him. Obviously, we know the Kennedy brothers had their issues with J. Edgar Hoover. He had a lot of power, yet he was not elected. So very dangerous to democracy. I think the level of control that he had and his willingness to intervene in things is seen in a funny example, the letters that the FBI wrote to Mad Magazine requesting that they take out a caricature of Mr. Hoover. On the more serious side, we have Mark Felt's account that when J. Edgar Hoover died, it was very much a race to the files, and Hoover's personal secretary, Helen Gandy, destroyed those files. What were in those files? Why did she have to destroy them? Felt would only say that they were personal. Felt himself was convicted for illegal break-ins, and he was pardoned by Reagan. All of this before it was known that Felt was Bob Woodward's deep throat source. Now, I bring up all this to say we have this bad side of the FBI. Yet, as in many things, the bad side is spooky and fun, and the good side is just kind of ho-hum. We don't even think about it. We take it for granted. So yeah, we have this perhaps paranoid, crazy individual was in charge of this secret agency and was violating the rights of citizens of the United States and controlling politics in a way that's not appropriate for a police force. But what about the other side? What about going to pre-FBI history when gangsters could roam around the country, outrunning and outgunning local police forces? What about the benefit of protection from crime that we got from this kind of admittedly power-hungry individual? Protection of banks and handling of kidnapping cases. There's a trade-off. And so I can't help with the total question of whether something like this big data is the right choice to make or whether it's going to be a privacy disaster. But I can red flag it and say it's something to be aware of as the policy's implemented. But I think you do have to look at both sides. I bring up the census because it was definitely the big data of its day, of 1787. And despite the fact that the Constitution was a document written with concern for government's power against the individual, in this case, it actually mandated a count of every citizen in the United States. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers. The actual enumeration shall be completed within 3 years and within every subsequent term of 10 years in such manner as they shall direct. They needed that data to make the system fair. And so Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of State, oversaw federal marshals fanning out and counting people in 1790. They did so in every state and the territories. The practice at the time was actually less private than today. Every household needed to be visited, and complete census schedules would be posted in two of the most public places within each jurisdiction of the marshal to remain for the inspection of all concerned. So this is back in 1790, run by the great supporter of individual rights, Thomas Jefferson. Yet, in each of these jurisdictions, you're seeing a poster with all of your friends' and neighbors' names. Why? Perhaps to be sure that it was effective, that everybody was counted, and people could check it. President Washington would get the aggregate amount of the description of persons. In a kind of funny way, Washington got the big data, not the little data. So at least in that area, Americans traded a little privacy for better representation and perhaps more money for their state. So I think that big data is something to watch. Americans as a people are more individualistic. We don't like this idea of trading our privacy, even where their gain is high. But on the other hand, we're realistic. In some ways, it relates to Alexander Hamilton and the question of the U.S. bank that we discussed a week or so ago, and where you come down on that. Because Hamilton's argument to Washington was, when he wanted to create this new Bank of the United States, is if we, the federal government, have a task to perform, then you have to give us the means. You can't give us a task to perform and not give us all the means to get it done. So if you create a National Institute of Health, tell it to better preserve the health of Americans, and then yet there is all this genomic data out there, which hopefully you can make anonymous and just look at the data in the aggregate, how could you simply not use it under that formula? Two things to look at, whether or not President Obama or the Defense Department goes forward with this big data plan, you have to remember the corporations will. Walmart, for instance, recently bought a Facebook app called Social Calendar. And I'm sure somehow they will have their computers talk to its computers when it comes time to stocking up on supplies for weddings and baby clothes. And regardless of what the president does here, the administration does here, what if other countries use this big data and we don't? Because we have the privacy concerns. Will they better fend off against natural disasters, find better energy sources, fight disease, and have smarter war drones because, let's say, the Chinese, the Russians, or French governments go for big data, and we decide on private concerns not to? Almost every question now of policy has to be seen in this multidimensional way. Dave Podner writes, in regard to the Anthony Kennedy cast, I don't want to be a conspiracy nut, but the idea of something as large as healthcare reform could be decided by so few could be a little off-putting. Well, thanks, Dave. And yes, I agree, it probably is off-putting where one justice or two justices decide things that have been debated by millions of voters, hundreds of congressmen and women, and then it's up to one guy. I suppose there are two things to say about this and put your fear in perspective. Healthcare reform got to the steps of the Supreme Court because it relied on a principle that is at least subject to question, that every person must, by mandate of the federal government, get insurance. It was a big step and ended up in the crosshairs of constitutional scrutiny. According to the Congressional Research Service, as of 2008, they list every act of Congress held unconstitutional, from Marbury v. Madison in 1801, which held that the Judiciary Act of 1789 was unconstitutional, to the 2005 Detainee Treatment Act. So between that time, only 165 of the myriad acts of Congress, 165, were held unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So it could be said that while the Supreme Court has a lot of power, they have been cautious about using that power. However, for supporters of healthcare reform, if you're one of them, past performance is no guarantee of future performance, as you know. And the record of not holding things unconstitutional often won't help. The Supreme Court seems to be on the mind of many. Al Evans writes in regard to the podcast about Justice Kennedy, an interesting podcast. You might also look into justices who switch sides, not really switched, but who were appointed as conservative or liberal and then moved sharply to the center and perhaps beyond. Yes, it's a great question, Al. And, you know, the famous quote is, "The biggest damn fool mistake I ever made." Dwight Eisenhower, about his appointment of Chief Justice Earl Warren. Yes, Ike regretted his choice of the popular governor of California, who was the first Republican appointment in 20 years, yet turned out to be as liberal on law and order issues and civil rights than the FDR or Truman appointees even. He didn't morph that much, though. Warren had been a moderate as California governor. On the court, he helped push the Brown versus Board of Education, and it would be a mistake to think that it is on that decision, the school integration case, where he incurred the anger of Ike. The Eisenhower administration actually supported that Brown decision. But later on the law and order cases, Miranda and other things, that's what led to Ike's statement, I suspect. One thing that's clear, you never wanted to get on the other side of Theodore Roosevelt's insult. I could carve a judge out of a banana with more backbone than he. Roosevelt was speaking of his appointment of Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. As a judge, he had shown more sympathy for labor unions than others. So, maybe Roosevelt felt, he's a supporter of a stronger national government. And a government that could take on large trusts. But in U.S. versus Northern Securities in 1904, he dissented. He disagreed with the president and the decision that approved the government's action in taking on the Northern Securities Trust. Oliver Wendell Holmes would be a lot more independent than anyone would expect. Holmes, the son of a well-known poet in Schenck versus United States, upheld the conviction of the head of the Socialist Party of America, one of the socialist parties that was against World War I. Some of those parties were for the war, and that had printed hundreds of thousands of flyers and leaflets urging people not to sign up for the draft. You cannot, he said, shout fire in a crowded movie theater. This was the same action. But then, just a year later, in Abrams v. United States, when we were now at peace, and a group of protesters threw leaflets from a window protesting our intervention in the Russian Revolution. He thought there that the government had overstepped and dissented in that case against a government that could sweep away opposition with law. It's suspected that the events of the Red Scare and the prosecutions that occurred had changed Holmes' mind. Though the circumstances of opposing a policy while we were at war and opposing a national draft versus opposing intervention in the Russian Revolution may have been a little different. Law and order was an issue important to President Nixon when he appointed his replacement for Earl Warren. That was Chief Justice Warren Burger. When Abe Fortas retired from the court, Nixon, after two choices were rejected by the Senate, went with Burger's friend from the circuit court, his fellow Minnesotan, Harry Blackmun. Dubbed the Minnesota Twins, they initially voted together quite a bit, and more on the conservative side of law. But Harry Blackmun authored Roe v. Wade and defended it all the way to the end of his career. And eventually, though he supported the death penalty in early rulings, later turned against it. Presidents have sometimes put trusted advisors on the court, as we discussed Abe Fortas, who had been on the court. He was Lyndon Johnson's advisor. Roger Taney was a friend to Andrew Jackson and a cabinet member. Abraham Lincoln put David Davis, his good friend from Illinois, on the court. So Franklin Roosevelt put Felix Frankfurter on the court. And it was not shocking entirely at that time. As one of the architects of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, it was expected that Frankfurter would be a liberal. Frankfurter had helped found the ACLU after the government had conducted raids of suspected communist radicals in the 1920s. He had called for new trials for Sacco and Vanzetti, immigrants sentenced to death on murder charges in Boston, which had become a cause celeb. As a New Dealer, he suggested progressive legislation to the president. But he watched as the Supreme Court stood in the way of the president and Congress making law. So when FDR appointed him to the Supreme Court in 1939, that was his guiding principle. He wanted the court not to act where the Congress or president had, unless they absolutely had to. Thus, he actually became more conservative justice by holding to that principle of non-intervention. In a 1941 decision, he upheld a statute requiring a Jehovah's Witness to salute the flag. In Dennis v. United States, he upheld the prosecution of the Communist Party and he disagreed with more liberal justices, Hugo Black and William O. Douglas, who felt that the 14th Amendment meant the Bill of Rights should be applied to the states. So while he had a share of liberal decisions, Brown v. Board of Ed signed on to immediately, Frankfurter did not turn out to be the liberal game changer on the court that some expected. And personally, he was known for giving long lectures to his colleagues. "He talks all the time," Earl Warren said of him. But I suppose he's an example of someone who surprised people based on his career before the court, but wasn't exactly a person who changed while on the court. Something else to discuss here. Is it always the justice who is changing? Or is it sometimes the court? And by the court, I mean not just the personnel on the court, but the cases that are being granted at any given time that are getting cert and the court is seeing at that specific time. Can that make the court a very different place? Gerald Ford appointed Justice John Paul Stevens in 1975, and this was his only appointment as a president. He was a jurist and a Cubs fan from Chicago, a moderate judge when he was appointed, but given the changes on the court and the cases considered, he became associated with the court's liberal wing. But Stevens always considered that it was the court that changed and not he. On two issues, one big, one small, Stevens changed his mind. Upon entering the court, he ruled in favor of overturning the ban on capital punishment, which upon his retirement, he rejected. But it's not so much a change in his mind as he asserts. "I felt the universe of defendants eligible in 1976 for the death penalty was so narrow, you could be sure that the punishment was appropriate in these cases. They were the most severe cases. But since changes in jury selection rules, like for instance, allowing prosecutors to query about the jurist's belief in the death penalty and unseat the jurors that disagreed, and with the impact of victim impact statements before sentencing for the death penalty, that in his view increased the number of death penalty potential cases, well beyond what he thought was a narrow group. So because of the changed circumstances, he said my vote in 1976 was incorrect. But he felt it was correct at the time. Stevens said he sometimes changed in the middle of a consideration of a case. In 1990, Illinois had a patronage system for political office, and at first, he kind of bought Antonin Scalia's line that patronage was as old as the Republic. But Stevens felt that didn't make it right. Evolving in his thinking, Stevens opposed any idea of a textual interpretation of the Constitution. The whole idea was to form a more perfect union. It wasn't something that was perfect to begin with, Stevens would say. From changing minds on the court to the changing national economic mind. When you're a young child, you want to grow up and work at a factory, right? Well, that's probably not the case. You probably wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. Ended up as a startup executive, an internet CEO, a software salesperson, a project manager, or a web designer, or something like that. We strive to put every American in college. We strive for jobs that will utilize the education that we have. Yet, in the aggregate, there seems to be a wanting for more of the type of jobs that we used to have in America, jobs making things. This is an interesting question. And Sandy Weinberger writes, on the My History Can Beat Up Your Politics Facebook site, wondering if you can comment on the percent of the economy is manufacturing versus service, of all types, public, private, and how nations fared as the percent of manufacturing declines. And here's the question Sandy asks, can we prosper with a shrinking heavy industry sector? Well, it gets more into economics, and I dabble there, but it's not my specialty, so I certainly referred you to a couple other places. But to some extent, I can't resist the question. I think manufacturing gets more attention these days. Certainly, it's getting some recent attention from the Obama administration. It helps to have Ohio as one of the key swing states in the 2012 election. Perhaps there is more emotional attachment to manufacturing work, making things. Sounds better. Blue collar, working man. It's connected with a higher level of union organization, which gives it an emotional appeal and a lobby group physically present in our politics as well. You might call it a Bob Seger factor. But when something is privileged, my analytical spider sense tingles. Does it deserve the elevated place it has? What's so bad about service economy? So just because a company makes a physical item, why is that more important than a service, an intangible? Let's look at it a bit, and we'll go back to history. And Alexander Hamilton, of course, thought that manufacturing was the basis of a new economy for America. He recommended tariffs to protect American industries, subsidies funded by those tariffs to help manufacturing, to give grants to people who would have to build the giant industrial machines we would need. He issued a report on manufacturers, which said the U.S. was in shabby shape in 1791 in terms of its industry. He himself, along with others, helped to fund an industrial area in New Jersey. But all of this talk is when we were building up from an agricultural economy. This is when the nation was in its infancy, relied on imported goods, providing very little services, when the rich countries of the world were the ones with the ironworks. And if all you did was raise corn and pigs, you'd be sending your coin over to the country that made stuff. In 1791, that would have been Great Britain and a little bit France. Now, in modern times, things are different from when Alexander Hamilton issued his report. So compare and contrast. Great Britain is one of many countries in modern times that is rich from not making stuff. Countries that are rich now make stuff, but they service stuff more. The World Bank shows, for instance, that high-income countries are, on average, 66% service, only 32% industrial manufacturing. Low-income countries are 35% service and 38% industrial. They make stuff, but their countries are not the seat of empires. The U.S. has transformed, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis. When Harry Truman was president, U.S. manufacturing was 26% of GDP, and now it's somewhere near 15%. And the estimates of this percentage vary a bit, but the estimates of the drop do not. But here's the thing. Where is, as in your question, the story of that country that went all services and then went bankrupt and suffered? I haven't seen it. In our own case, despite that manufacturing decline I talked about from Harry Truman's time to our time, we didn't have a decline in GDP, but an increase, $244 billion to $14 trillion now. I know, population's changed, inflation's changed, right. But what about per capita GDP? It's up from $9,561 to $41,000, real dollars, 2009 dollars. And we are not alone in this move to more of a service economy. Here's UN numbers. Germany went from 35% in 1970 to 19%. Manufacturing. Canada from 21 to 11, Brazil from 24 to 13, and the world from 27 to 15. That's world average, and yes, I know that Bill Gates walks into a bar and everyone is a millionaire on average. But it does suggest that the idea that a good economy can only come from factories may be misleading. There is a counter to this, of course. The manufacturing may have dropped lower in the United States than other nations. It may have dropped faster as well. Germany, Switzerland, Japan have higher than world average incomes, and they have higher than world average percent of manufacturing. And there is, of course, this question, which is probably embedded in the question you asked, of how far can this really go? Okay, so maybe it's 15, 13%, whatever right now is making stuff, right? What if it gets to 2%? What if it gets to 100%? Is that when we're really in trouble and we're having to send our coin to countries that make stuff? An example of an evolution in our economy can be seen with the agricultural percentages, where it was the lion's share of the economy, certainly not measured exactly in 1791, but it's only 1.2% of the U.S. economy now. And it's seen as something we have to protect and defend, the farms, right? Willie Nelson tractor, all that. I don't know that our manufacturing percentage will get that far down. There are some things that just have to be made here until true teleportation devices are designed. There are a few items that can't wait for what is normally sea shipping from China. I think in a podcast like this, history, politics, what I talk about, so I would encourage you to listen to some other places, ask some other folks as well. I'm skeptical of the idea that there is something so wrong with the idea of service, but that's just me. I like to listen to a podcast called Econ Talk. And a few episodes back, he talked to Adam Davison, who is also on another podcast, the Planet Money podcast. Both of those are good economic casts. I tend to listen to Econ Talk just a little more, quote, in the profession of economics, but it's long and you got to put some time into it. There was one with this Adam Davison about manufacturing. He described a factory for car parts, custom car parts that had to be there in, say, 3 days anywhere across America. So this plant had to be, you know, located in the United States. One, maybe two people on this factory floor and a lot of robots. The people are there to program the robots, to set them up, and to fix them when they break down. They're engineers, and they aren't the kind of guys who just chisel or scrape or aim a drill bit. They're experts in calculus and physics to be able to figure out the exact angle to aim the robot's scalpel in order to make a certain custom part. Yes, these are the manufacturing jobs you might see of 2012. That given that it takes less people, it could be impossible to boost the economy with new manufacturing jobs because it takes less people, a lot less people, to make in 2009 what it took to make in 1950. Productivity has increased every year since then. I've seen an estimate as much as 2.3% every year since then. So I guess a funny way to think of this is, you know, is the future of America with the steel worker or with Bob Seger, the singer that sings about the steel worker and the steel worker's life, you know? Yes, obviously there can only be one Bob Seger, so that's not really a good representation of the service economy. But what about the people that sing for the product? And that would be the salespeople, right, who are out there promoting, marketing people, people who do the accounting for the company, people who go out and try to get investors for that plant. So, you know, which one do we look at? I suspect we are viewing services as less valuable than they are, as low paying, and as something that only our own countrymen and women would be interested in, as opposed to making products. That makes sense if we speak of waiters or retail salespeople, right? We're just selling stuff to ourselves, bringing us pie and coffee. But when you start talking about an e-commerce web designer, you know, someone who can program an API, a doctor who can get on an online visualization and make commentary, a copyright lawyer, a financier, and all the service that might go with these professions, a business startup consultant, a writer, a mobile app programmer. Our ability to define jobs hurts in answering this question. Our ability to define services is difficult too. Cell phones, computers, these are products made, but the factory part of those products is not the most interesting part, I would suspect. It's the service that comes around it. They're products wrapped in service. I think service jobs get complicated in so much that you can't even think about them if you're a government planner or us talking on this podcast. You know, it's something that entrepreneurs create, the market for goods and services create, because companies decide what function they need. Maybe a guy that designs Excel spreadsheets all day. That may be what's needed, at least in the time. So I think it's just something that's hard to define. You know, people don't go to school to be a project manager or a salesperson, but in many cases, that's where the jobs are. Sales is a great example here. Sales is something that is often missing from any kind of discussion of implementing government policy, right? They like to think of core professions that are easy to define. Sales is kind of a hard one to define. What does a salesperson really do? But in the most positive sense, a salesperson can add value to a product that's been made, a manufactured product. Add a lot of value by getting it to the right person, saving the buying company time. And obviously a salesperson, and this is the reason I think sales employs so many people, is that they're obviously adding value to the companies that manufactured the stuff because they're getting users for it. And a final word on this is to keep in mind that government is services. So as that grows, it employs people and increases the percentage of services. Back in Harry Truman's time, we had a smaller government in all aspects than we do now. To reduce the service component of our economy, we'd have to have the government perform less tasks, hire less police, less inspectors, and the like. So to wrap up, I think my take on it is anything that produces dollars is a part of the economy, and it's a positive thing, and it can be, if done well, sold to other countries. If we're paying for it here, it's something that other people would want as well. So I personally don't have much issue with the increase in the service portion of the economy. I would suggest that there may be a portion when it gets so small that it requires government protection so that it doesn't go to zero. I do question whether the current ratio is worthy of intervention at this point. And the questions keep coming. Kirk Roth asks, I feel like giving some feedback on the recent Your TV Lied to You cast, the one about presidential scandals. I've been listening for years, and this is one of my favorites. One question, though. The commercial breaks in 1972, it was fun to hear them, and I pretended that I was there watching because this was before my time. Perhaps the fun of it was the reason for including them. But I did find myself wondering if they were including to lead to a subtle point you wanted to make, perhaps the distortions of the public media or the, quote, salesmanship of politics. Well, thanks, Kirk. I appreciate it. I think the commercial breaks in there were entertainment, and that's my sense of it, an overall sense of what the average Joe watching TV back then would have seen. It's not really ABC's fault that they didn't catch Watergate. Maybe it's a little their fault. They were being lied to by members of the nation's government at the time. But I thought it was good to introduce the idea that, quote, Watergate existed earlier than Nixon's I'm Not a Crook speech, his ride on the green helicopter, even the Senate hearings, that it was available to voters and media during the 1972 campaign as they were making their decision. But that it, as a scandal, was not ready yet, perhaps. It wasn't looked at enough, and to a degree, the press was intimidated by a popular White House at that time. In 72, as I said, you couldn't even call it Watergate. That came afterwards, especially as the administration's performance went down, and then the scandal took on new meaning. It's too much to say that gas prices go up, so we gotta find a scandal with the president. But it might suggest that scandals may be fungible. Our perception of them may be fungible. They're worse when people are grumpy, forgiven a little when times are good. And if that's true, the current administration, since things are obviously not rosy, would be extra vulnerable to a scandal if that occurred. So that's my thinking on that. But the television commercials and the whole approach, I don't mind if you go with your interpretation rather than mine. I'm going to give you that wall of history, and I don't mind if it becomes like a Rothko painting. And you take from it what you will, your interpretation. While I always try to make some current politics statement and tie it in, I kind of don't mind keeping it more and more at the inference level. You have freedom of speech, freedom of thought, and there's no reason to submit to an omnipotent narrator, even if it's me. But I do want to thank you for listening. The website is www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. Facebook site, link to it there. You can buy the archives for $14.99. Hours and hours and hours of topics we've discussed. We got an election coming up, so listening to the archives from 2008, I think, will be very interesting as we move along here. If you do like the program, please tell somebody about it. Post it on your blog, tell iTunes, ring a bell in the town square, and thanks for listening.